From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, why we're only today learning about Nazi atrocities in the former Soviet Union.
It was unknown because it was done in Soviet Union. And after the war, at least it was a Cold War, I would say it was not politically correct to speak so much about the Jews who were Soviet.
Then we'll talk with a U.S. trade expert to learn how and why the U.S. has fallen behind in the global economy.
And Paralympian Rhodes Scholar and international businesswoman Bonnie St. John tells us about successful ways to empower girls.
The power of who you are and who you're going to become is really dependent on something inside. Is your vision, your self-esteem, your confidence, and your ability to set goals and communicate and connect with other people.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The atrocities committed by the Nazis in the Second World War, mainly against Jews, but also other groups, are well known today. Well, many of them are, anyway. 72 years ago, the war was ending. And the horrific murders of millions in the concentration camps of Europe were coming to light.
But there are other stories of killings, thousands upon thousands, that we are still learning about today. That's in part through the efforts of Father Patrick Dubois, a Catholic priest in France. His organization, Yihadin Unum, has been investigating and collecting evidence from other sites of mass execution during the Holocaust for the past decade.
Dubois was in Milwaukee last week to launch an exhibition at Jewish Museum Milwaukee that presents the results of those 10 years of investigations. But 2 years ago, he was also visiting Milwaukee to speak about his work, and he joined us in the studio then. Father Dubois, it is an honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
Would you please tell us first how you became involved in this project? I understand it's personal.
Yeah, that's two stories. It's my own story and after the story of my organization. My own story began by my childhood. My grandfather was deported in Ukraine from France and in a camp of Soviet prisoners. And he never spoke about this village called Ravaruska. And I wanted to know what happened there. So when I became priest, I went back to Ravaruska and I found that, in fact, they shot 18,000 Jews there and that nobody knew where they were. So it began like that, by a quest for the mass grave of these Jews from Ravaruska.
So how did that speak to you as a Catholic and as a priest? Why was it so important to find this?
It spoke to me first as a little son of, not like as a priest or the, you know, if my grandfather was not the grandfather of a priest because he died when I was 17. He was not really on the Catholic side of the family. So it spoke to me first as a quest to know what happened and why my grandfather that I loved so much, why he didn't speak, what he saw, what he did. It was first a family request, not a church request.
Once you became a priest, did the church agree for you to do this work? Was there any kind of resistance?
No. You know, in France, I don't know here, but when you follow a project for human values and in relationship with the Jews, you are supported by the church. And as I was already director of the relation for the church with the Jews in France, so it was highly supported by the Cardinal of Paris. Yeah. But to be supported, it doesn't mean it is a church job. You know, we need independence because we need the liberty of scientific research. What we find. If it's good for the church, it's good. If it's not good for the church, it's okay. Never the cardinal will ask me, what did you find? Is it good for the church? Because we know the church failed in many places and also succeeded in other places. So I cannot rebuild the story of the church of Poland and Ukraine and so on.
That is part of the history, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people know about the Holocaust. They certainly know that in the concentration camps, many, many millions of people were killed. What they probably don't know about is the groups that you're investigating and the kind of killings that happened this way. Had there been any research in that before you started? Did you have?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there were researchers. There were German researchers, American researchers. But effectively, in the public opinion, when you say Holocaust, people think Auschwitz. They think train, they think gas chamber, they think deportation. And they don't realize that for the Soviet Jews, it was not the same story. It was a story of shooting village, but by special units called Einsatzgruppen. Altogether, they killed 2.3 million Jews. So it's really one third of the Jews who have been shot one by one by a German killer or by local killer. So it was unknown because it was done in Soviet Union. And after the war, it was a Cold War, I would say it was not politically correct to speak so much about the Jews were Soviet.
Have you had any resistance from the Ukrainian government or from the Russian government or from the Polish government in doing the research that you've been doing and turning up the information that you've turned up?
You know, we go on a very basic level. We interview the farmers who are living near the mass graves who saw the execution of the Jews or were requisitioned to dig the mass grave, to carry the Jews, etc. So we are on a very basic level. And I would say, no, we didn't meet any problem with the authorities. Oppositely, I would say we have good diplomatic relation, even with Russia today. We encourage these researches. We are not a political organization. We are only here for the victim of the fascist.
How much more work do you think there is to do?
I think there is still 1 million Jews to find. We found the mass graves of 1.3 million Jews. We have interviewed 4,000 farmers who were present at the killing sites, and we identified the archives of the crime. So we could settle the evidences of these crimes for 1,700 extermination sites. But I estimate it stays 1 million, and we still have only, I estimate, more 4 years because the witnesses are very old. The farmers were present as children, but now the children are 80 years old. And so we have to run. It's why we accelerate with my organization, Yarad. We go 17 times a year, 17 days each time, 11 person each time. I have 4 teams of investigation, in fact. Actually, I have 1 team in Poland. In a few days, a team will go to Russia. Myself, I will go to Serbia in 1 week. We skip the winter because it's too difficult in winter. But during the non-winter season, we make these 17 trips. So we run against time because sometimes we arrive too late in a village and people tell me, Madame Anna, she saw everything, but she died last week.
That must be incredibly frustrating when that happens.
Yeah, it is because we came so many kilometers. But globally, until now, we find many, many witnesses because the killing of the Jews were done in public. And they killed also the gypsies in the same way. So we investigate both for the Jews, both for the gypsies, both the parties. And I wouldn't mean any civilian who was assassinated by the German units because we cannot make any difference. Sometimes also they are in the same mass grave.
I was going to say the Roma were also victims of the Nazi atrocities, too.
Yarad, my organization, we have built a separate branch for the Roma in Brussels, in the capital of Europe. And we participated this week for the vote of European Parliament, who recognized for the first time the genocide of the Roma, and we dedicate a day for the Roma. We found the 70 extermination sites of Roma without a stone. And today the Roma are very segregated in Europe. And we think that until the time we recognize their genocide, they will never get back their dignity. So we are fighting also for the present.
Father, do you find the rise of anti-Semitism and certainly anti-Roma feelings in Europe distressing? I mean, looking at it from this side of the pond, it seems like there's a lot of very negative feeling toward Jews and Roma increasing in Europe rather than decreasing.
So it's very different for the Jews and for the Roma. For the Jews, anti-Semitism actually is physically violent. Many Jews have been attacked. Some Jews have been killed in Europe by shooters. But as says the president of the Jewish community of France, all the shooters were Muslims. So there is really a high rise, I would say, of hate of the Jews in a part of Islamic world in France. So it's sure that the level of insecurity for the Jews is very high. Some Jews decide to leave France to go to Israel or to America, and some others decide to stand. Even for my organization, we have to change the place. We have to buy a house to be safe because we are actually in a Muslim place. And that's a very new situation. For the Roma, it's something else. There is a segregation in many, many countries in Europe and in many countries where they have been persecuted during the genocide. So we have to them to establish the base of their dignity. It's totally two different stories.
Yes. I think the anti-Semitism, the rise of that in France and in other parts of Europe is newer. And the Roma, as you say, have always sort of been on the periphery. And
what is new for the Jews is that they are physically attacked. It's not only in the world. The classic anti-Semitism in France is still there, but it doesn't concern all the population. But the physical risk are always coming from Muslims. And we have 1,700 people who are actually fighting with Islamic State. So we are very afraid when they come back what they will do or what they are actually preparing to do. Every synagogue, every school is under protection of army. Now, we never saw that in France in the war.
How does the church feel about that? Is the church trying to mitigate that in any way?
The church has the same problem because, as you heard the news, some radical Muslim are killing the Christian in public now nearly every day. And this last week in Ethiopian Christian, but I would say will be next. So we try also, and myself, I will be in Iraq in a few days to interview also Christian survivors and Yazidi survivors of Islamic State, because today it's burning. It's burning for the Jews. It's burning for the Christian. And I cannot close my eye to the present. If I worked so hard to find the Jews, it was to prevent actual genocide. And actually, we are not far to genocide the Yazidi and the Christian in Islamic States. So I will go myself in part of Iraq when I will interview Yazidi, a survivor with a tribe who is totally nearly annihilated by the Islamic State. And also thousands and thousands of Christian refugees who are trying to survive and find a visa to go away. As the ex-president of the Jews in France said, to be Christian actually in Islamic State, it's like was to be in Jew during Hitler State.
I find that so depressing that we don't seem to make progress somehow. As humans, we seem to constantly find reasons to do this to each other. Do you despair at all?
No, it's a disease. You know, willing to exterminate a part of the world to build a new world is a disease. For me, the genocide is a human disease. It took the German, it took nearly all Europe during 4 or 5 years and before the war with the rise of anti-Semitism. It's coming back with the rise of anti-Semitism. But it's rising also all the radical Islam who are thinking to save the world in killing so many civilians. It's a disease. We have to name the disease and we have to cure the disease. So for me, the first thing is to wake up the people in letting them know what happens, because everybody wants to sleep well and to forget like it was during Holocaust. I'm sure many people sleep well. Actually, we are killing people in many parts of the planet and we still sleep well. So I want to be part of the people who make a wake-up call. And secondly, to teach new generation to fight. I'm teaching in Georgetown University, and another person of my team is teaching in Sorbonne, another is teaching in Cologne in Germany. And we are trying to train new generation to be the firewall, I would say, against this disease. But it's a disease as contagious as Ebola.
Well, Father, I know you are suffering from the flu, and I don't want to stress your voice anymore, but I do want to thank you so much for stopping by and talking with us about your life's work, and best of luck in Iraq.
Thank you to you, because without the media, you know, nobody will hear the voice of this woman who have been actually raped, these children who are sold to this young man who was shot in public with camera like it was in 42, 43, 44. The media are the key of the firewall for tomorrow. Thank you.
Father Patrick Dubois is a Catholic priest in France and president of Yehudim Unim, a Paris-based organization which works to uncover sites and new evidence of Jewish mass execution during the Holocaust. He's also the author of the book, The Holocaust by Bullets, a priest's journey to uncover the truth behind the murder of 1.5 million Jews.
Father Dubois was in Milwaukee last week to launch the 5-week run of the Holocaust by Bullets exhibit at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. You can find out more information about the work of Yahad in Unum and the exhibit at WUWM.com. Our interview with Father Dubois first aired in 2015.
After a break, we'll talk with a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations about why the United States has fallen behind in the global economy. That conversation comes your way next when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. In one of his first executive orders after the inauguration, Donald Trump withdrew the United States from negotiations over the TPP, also known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The proposed trade agreement was used by both Democrats and Republicans during the campaign as a proxy for the pitfalls of globalization. Since then, it remains unclear how the president's rhetoric on trade will translate into action.
Edward Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, who specializes in U.S. economic competitiveness and trade policy. He was in Milwaukee this past February to talk about his recent book, Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. And he met with us then to talk about U.S. trade policy. Edward Alden, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
It's great to be here with you. Thank you.
So just to get sort of a history of trade liberalization in the United States, you know, how did we get here?
Well, let me give you the 30-second history. So the 30-second history is you go back to the late 1920s and 1930s, and we tried a very different approach. So the United States, in response to the Great Depression, closed its market to imports with the hope that by protecting ourselves from import competition, we would manufacture more stuff ourselves and we'd all do really well. Well, the result was every other country followed suit. The Great Depression lingered for much longer than it needed to. The world descended into war, et cetera. In the wake of World War II, American leaders and British leaders and others decided that one way to prevent a repeat of that catastrophe was to create a system of global trade rules that would gradually, over time, bring down the taxes that were charged on imports. They're called tariffs. And in the Second World War, on a lot of products, they were 50, 60, 70%. So huge taxes on imports, which made it very difficult to sell a product made in Canada into the United States or made in the United States into Europe. And so basically, American leaders believed that it would be a good thing to bring these charges down over time. And the United States helped organize a series of what were called global trading rounds in which tariffs were brought down dramatically over the course of the next 40, 50 years. And gradually, the trade negotiations became more and more complicated. They included not just eliminating tariffs, but dealing with government regulations and subsidies for corporations. What would the rules be on those? And a whole series of other things. And then expanded from there into these narrower deals, the NAFTA with Canada and Mexico regional deal. We've done a lot of bilateral trade deals. So over the sort of past half century, we've built this huge global network of trade rules that's now under the biggest challenge that any of us has seen in our lifetimes.
It seems like it's a really complex web of these different deals. But at the center of it, it looks like the United States is one of the major players.
The United States accounts for a quarter of the world's economy. And it has been the leader in terms of setting these trade rules and trying to enforce them around the world. So the United States, more than any other single country, created the modern global trading system in which we live.
And yet at the same time, the United States, it seems, has disproportionately been affected pretty negatively by this globalization?
Well, this was, you know, obviously a huge debate in the last campaign. And you know, if you go back 20 or 30 years, most Americans thought that they were winners from globalization because it's brought us a lot of good things, you know, cheaper clothing, cheaper television sets, been good for U.S. foreign policy. We built strong alliances in Asia and Europe in part through trade. But it has also hit parts of our economy very hard, particularly the manufacturing sector. And so, you know, you go back to the 60s and 70s, we used to make television sets here. We don't make television sets in the United States anymore. Obviously, a lot of our cars are imported. We import a lot of steel now. There are a whole lot of products that are made abroad, and that has had the effect of putting some manufacturing workers out of jobs. Where it really hit hard was in the 2000s, following China's entry into the World Trade Organization, which is the big umbrella trade organization for global trade rules. And in the 2000s, about a third of all U.S. manufacturing jobs were lost. That wasn't all trade story. Some of that was technology. Robots are increasingly replacing people in manufacturing. But that hit a lot of places very hard, particularly in the industrial Midwest. So there have been some real losers along with, you know, many winners.
You know, I think like a lot of people, I don't know that much about trade policy, except what gets filtered down through politicians. And as you mentioned, it was a big issue in this last election season during the campaign. What are they getting right about the story, and what are they kind of missing?
I think the thing they are getting right about the story is that as a country, we should have paid a lot more attention to the workers and communities who were affected negatively by trade. And we just didn't. I mean, if you compare it to Europe, if you lose your job in Europe, you know, the government swoops in. There are retraining programs. There's temporary income support. If you need to move to another location to find a new job, they'll help you do that. We do very little of that for our workers in the United States. So we simply didn't help people adjust to the competition. So that's really a very legitimate complaint. I think the parts of it that are not legitimate is that a lot of this was going to happen anyway. I mean, globalization isn't just something that governments went out there and snapped their fingers and created. It's a product of the fact that you now have big container ships, so it's a lot cheaper to ship stuff across the Pacific Ocean to come to the United States. It's a result of the internet. Companies can now produce components all over the world and coordinate this for final assembly, you know, in the United States or in China or wherever. Now, I'm carrying an iPhone in my pocket. The iPhone is assembled. It's a little thing. You know what is it? It's about, you know, 2.5 inches by 5 inches. There are components from 30 different countries in this iPhone, assembled in a Taiwanese-owned contracting factory in southern China and then shipped to the United States. And the company that does that, Apple, is an American company. It creates a lot of good jobs for Americans. So a lot of this stuff would have happened anyway. The trade rules, however, have probably accelerated it. I think there's no question about that. And so people who are unhappy about trade, you don't get a vote on globalization. You don't get a vote on container shipping. You don't get a vote on the internet. You do get a vote on trade agreements and whether your politicians are going to support it or not. So I think a lot of the focus of anger over the disruption caused by globalization ends up directed at these trade agreements and at the politicians who have supported them.
Now, Trump is very against trade agreements, and he has been for decades. It's an issue that introduced him really into politics. That was one of the main issues that he picked up on when he first entered into politics. So he, right off the bat, signs an executive order effectively ending our negotiations over the TPP.
That's correct. Yeah. So I mean, trade is a foundational issue for Donald Trump. I mean, with a lot of his beliefs, it's hard to know how firmly he's committed to them, whether he adopted them for the campaign, hard to know whether he's going to stick with it. Trade, that's not the case. So the first time he flirted with the idea of running for president, it was in the mid-1980s, and he introduced himself to the country by taking out a full-page ad in the New York Times denouncing Japan over its large trade surplus with the United States and the fact that we were paying for their defense while they were in his term, screwing us on trade. He's believed that for a long time and ran on that very strongly in the campaign. You know, for Trump, the trade deficit is kind of a scorecard. If they're selling us more than they're buying from us, they're winning and we're losing. And the United States, for a variety of reasons, has for decades now run a very large trade deficit, particularly with China, with Germany, with Japan, and with Mexico. So those are all targets for Trump. What concerns me about Trump is I don't really think he has a strategic vision. He is really a genuine old-fashioned protectionist. You have to go back to Herbert Hoover to find the last time that the Oval Office was occupied by a president who believed that cutting the United States off from global trade would be a good thing for the country. And I think history's taught us that that's not likely to be the case. You take the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The biggest problem in global trade right now is China. And there are lots of ways in which China does not abide by the rules. It plays fast and loose with the agreements it's entered into in the World Trade Organization. And any successful trade policy that's going to do something to help American manufacturing has to focus on a tough strategic policy to get China to play by the rules. Well, so what's President Trump's first action? He walks away from a trade agreement that would have linked the United States to Japan, to Australia, to Singapore, to a dozen Pacific Rim countries under a set of rules favorable to the United States and not so favorable to China. So by walking away from that agreement, he's just given away what was potentially the biggest source of leverage that the United States had to put pressure on China. So I just worry that he doesn't have the strategic vision to carry out a trade policy that's likely to achieve the goals he wants, which I think are reasonable ones, which is to restore manufacturing to a somewhat greater share of the U.S. economy than it has currently.
You wrote an op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that kind of questioned, again, Trump's tactics. When it comes to NAFTA, what are we looking at?
Well, I think, you know, again, if you look at Trump's goals are to build more manufacturing investment, more manufacturing jobs in the United States. To be clear, that's really hard. I mean, the share of the U.S. workforce in manufacturing has been declining since the early 1970s. We used to have a quarter of the American workforce in manufacturing. Today, it's less than 9%. That's a big decline. That is not all a trade story by any means. Most of that is a technology story. We use robots in the factories. We're far more productive than we've ever been before. The United States actually makes more stuff than it ever has before with a fraction of the workforce. So those are big trends that are not going to disappear. Within that, however, you can do things to encourage companies to locate and expand in the United States. And the administration is talking about things on the tax front, talking about investments in infrastructure that I think could really help with that. The NAFTA renegotiation is challenging, right? Because the way NAFTA works, it's an agreement among the United States and Canada and Mexico. And what it's supposed to do is encourage investment in North America. The idea is to have kind of seamless commerce across North America. If you look at the auto industry, I mean, cars are made of components from Canada, Mexico, assembled in different places. The auto industry is completely integrated across continental borders. So any renegotiation of NAFTA is going to have to be within that spirit. But of course, Trump's been going after Mexico. He doesn't want companies moving to Mexico, wants to bring work back from Mexico to the United States. Not clear how you do that under NAFTA. NAFTA is about North America. You could tear it up, but then that creates a whole another set of potential problems.
It does seem like the Trump administration has been kind of bullying companies that have moved specifically to Mexico. He's, you know, threatened tariffs on Mexican products, which have concerned a lot of people. Where do those tactics end?
Yeah, I actually don't mind a little bit of bullying. And I was pleased to see Trump go after Carrier. You know, any of your listeners who saw the video of the Carrier managers announcing to the workers in the factory that their jobs were going to be moved to Mexico, it was pretty appalling. And I think Trump was right to be outraged by it. I do think, unfortunately, one of the things that's happened with American companies, and our companies are really successful. I mean, we have, you know, the lion's share of the most successful multinational companies in the world are headquartered in the United States. You started off your question about, you know, losers from globalization. Well, American companies have been big winners from globalization, and that's been good for a lot of Americans. But I think in the process, they've forgotten about their commitments and obligation to the United States. You know, being American companies gives them a lot of benefits in terms of workers who are educated here by American schools and American universities, an American government that will fight for them around the world if they run into business problems in China or Mexico or anywhere else. I think those companies owe something to the United States in return, and I think they've forgotten about that. So I didn't and don't have a problem with Trump reminding companies that they should be looking wherever they can for investment opportunities in the United States. But he's got to follow that up with something more. you've got to change the economics in some ways. You've got to make the United States a better place to invest through tax reform, through regulatory reform, through investment in infrastructure, through expansion of community colleges and other things to make sure that the skilled workers are there that the manufacturing operations need. You know, bluster and bullying alone is only going to get you so far.
Well, and that's something you mentioned in your book, a deficit in skilled workers. You know, there's this kind of dream, I think, especially strong for Wisconsinites that, you know, will return at some point to this time in which people graduate from high school, they go work at the factory, they, you know, have a nice blue-collar job. Are we going to return to that, or do we have to be looking at other solutions?
I mean, you're not, clearly, right? The nature of manufacturing work has changed substantially. A lot of it now is involved in running computers and running robots that are building things. It's much more technical and sophisticated than it was a generation ago. People who are working in those jobs need at least community college level skills. They're not going to walk straight out of high school into those jobs, and they're certainly not going to walk into them if they don't finish high school. But, you know, Wisconsin has the second highest percentage of its labor force in manufacturing of any state in the United States, second only to Indiana. 16% of workers here. Those are pretty good jobs. They pay in this region on average about 30% more than other jobs. So that is still potentially a good career path for a lot of young people, but you have to set it up to allow them to be successful. We've seen, for instance, a drying up of apprenticeship programs. A lot of companies used to have apprenticeship programs. They've diminished by roughly half over the last decade. Companies are reluctant to train workers on their own. There need to be cooperative efforts between state and local governments, federal government, and companies to make sure we're training the workers that these companies are going to need. Is it going to solve Wisconsin's employment issues? No. I think over time, gradually, more and more work is going to be in the service sector in one form or another. But it's still an important part of the economy, and it continues to be the most productive part of our economy. A lot of the growth we see comes out of the manufacturing sector.
Now, do you see these initiatives coming down from the federal government or state governments?
I would honestly like to see more of them coming out of local and state governments. I mean, one of the arguments that I make in my book is that federal trade policies should be enacted more in the service of state priorities. You know, so you have here in Wisconsin, strong and successful industries in energy and power systems, in water is another area where this is a real world leader. You know, what can we do through trade policies? What can we do through export promotion at the national level to help this state and other develop its competitive advantages? And I think I argue in my book, one of the problems with U.S. trade policy, it's been done entirely from the top down without taking input from state and local governments on what their economic development strategies are, what they're looking for in terms of developing regional economies. And so I think we need much closer cooperation that's coming more from the bottom up and much less from the top down.
So ultimately, do you feel hopeful for the Trump administration? You know, what do you think about the future?
I don't know. On Mondays and Wednesdays and Fridays, I'm hopeful. And on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Saturdays, I despair. My concern is that he does not yet have a team in place to carry out any sort of rational policy to try to achieve his ends. I'm quite supportive of his goals. I would like to see a manufacturing resurgence in the United States. I would like to see more investment in the United States. I would like to see our trade deficit lessened. I think we've run this chronic trade deficit for decades, which is not a good thing for us, not a good thing for the world. I just worry that his methods could be extremely damaging. Start slapping tariffs on imports from Mexico, which violates rules that the United States played the lead in negotiating. Other countries are going to retaliate. That's going to hurt exports from the United States. This region is extremely dependent on exports. If it wasn't for strong export growth over the last decade, Wisconsin would still be in recession. So you know, the notion that the problem is all on the import side, well, no, the problem is also expanding exports. And you start doing stupid things like slapping arbitrary tariffs on imports, and other countries are going to retaliate, and we are going to lose from that. So I'm very worried about some of the tactics that he and his team seem to be embracing. But I'm optimistic about the goals, and I'm hoping that, you know, when Wilbur Ross is confirmed as the Commerce Secretary, when we have a U.S. Trade Representative, that we'll start to see a rational strategy tacked on to a reasonable set of goals.
Well, Ted, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and coming in studio.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Edward Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He specializes in U.S. economic competitiveness, U.S. trade policy, visa, and immigration policy. He's also the author of Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. He was in Milwaukee this past February for UW-Milwaukee's annual Fireside Forum series, which is presented by the Institute of World Affairs.
Coming up next, we'll talk with Paralympian and motivational speaker Bonnie St. John, who was in town last month. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Many of us dream of becoming Olympians. Most of us content ourselves with watching them on TV. But despite losing her leg as a child, Bonnie St. John lived her Olympic dream and was the first African-American to win Winter Olympic medals. She took home a silver and two bronze at the 1984 Winter Paralympics in Innsbruck, Austria.
Today, St. John has not only Olympian on her resume, but also Fortune 500 business consultant, Rhodes Scholar, former White House official, and leadership expert. She's written seven books, including her latest, Micro Resilience, Minor Shifts for Major Boosts in Focus, Drive, and Energy.
St. John was in Milwaukee last month to speak at a Girls on the Run of Greater Milwaukee annual fundraising event, and she came by the studio then to share her story with Audrey Nowakowski.
Well, the crazy part of my story is that I grew up in San Diego where there's no snow, and I had my leg amputated when I was 5 years old due to a birth defect. My leg didn't grow. The growth was stunted. And I'm black, the first African-American in Winter Olympics. So it's one-legged black girl from San Diego becomes Olympic ski racer. It's a crazy story.
It is, yeah. It's fantastic, too. But I'm curious. The Olympics you participated in were the 1984 in Austria. What was the sporting environment like going into those Olympics?
It was early days in the Paralympics. I think it was only the third World Games for the disabled, Winter Disabled. And so there wasn't a lot of infrastructure. So people always say, oh, so you stayed in the Olympic Village. No, I stayed in a bed and breakfast in Innsbruck. And they fed us continental breakfast. And we were like, no, we have to ski all day. So they were like, okay, we can give you cold cuts. You know, it was very awkward. And I shared a bed with another athlete. You know, I mean, it was just like you can't even imagine. I had gloves that were mismatched from the lost and found that I had gotten somewhere. You know, we got a sweater and a jacket, and that was it.
So, not
so nowadays, it's amazing. I was on the presidential delegation to the 2010 Games in Vancouver, and the Paralympic athletes are now, it's done exactly like the Olympics. So they get to stay in the Olympic Village. They have masseuses. They have doctors. They get three trash bags full of clothes that are all the branded clothing, you know. So it was really exciting for me to see how far that's come and that our Paralympic U.S. team is really, is by law, part of our U.S. Olympic team, and they're treated on par, and the excitement and the training and the athleticism that you see, I mean, I think is almost more moving because you're watching people that don't have perfect bodies and perfect genetics who are doing excellence in world class. And I think that's a great example for our children, for everyone to say, don't wait for things to be right before you go out and achieve excellence.
Well, and as someone who grew up in an area without snow, learning how to ski, did you have to have a particularly tougher mental mindset when you were learning to ski? I mean, how did it come about that you said, I like the sport, I want to learn it, and to be able to pursue it all the way to the Olympic level?
A friend of mine in high school, Barbara Warmath, invited me to go skiing with her family over Christmas vacation. She actually took notebook paper and wrote a little certificate and tore it out and gave it to me for my birthday. And it's an amazing story because she's white, I'm black. Her family lived in La Jolla, which if you know San Diego, you know, you drive to the beach. It's some of the most beautiful beaches in the world. I lived in National City, which is only 25 minutes away, but it's if you drive to the beach from there, it's shipping yards and Navy and gangs and, you know, you're near the Mexican border. It was like worlds apart. But she turned to her one-legged black friend from the wrong side of the tracks and said, "Skier." That's about competitiveness, putting somebody who's so different on the team. We won more medals. If I hadn't been on the team, we wouldn't have won as many medals. There wasn't another American right behind me. And so companies think about competitiveness and diversity and the strength of our differences. And, you know, Barbara Wormath picking me out and bringing me into something I wouldn't have done otherwise made America win more medals. And I think that's what we need to be focusing on. When you look at our team that went to Rio, it's amazing. You know, there's the preppy rowers from Princeton and there's the track stars with tattoos all over and the shot putters look like they're from Duck Dynasty, yes. You know. And, oh, we even had the woman in the hijab who was fencing and won medals, you know. Mm-hmm. And the gymnastics team looked like the United Nations, you know. So that's America. And that's what makes us competitive and strong.
Well, and after you won your medals at the Olympic Games, as it was interesting to find out that it wasn't as well constructed as we think of the Olympics now. But did that change the sense of pressure either that you put on yourself or from outside forces after that was done to then do the next best thing?
Well, I think all along, you know, there's no farm team for one-legged black girls in San Diego to go skiing. So whereas, again, when you think of people doing well in sports, you think, oh, they get picked out at a young age and they get taken to this camp and then they get selected for that. As a one-legged athlete, I had to find my own coaches. I had to raise money. I had to organize airline tickets and I got a scholarship to a ski training school. But I did a lot of the initiative for that. So I had to organize it, which I think gave me a lot of strength to be in my own business. I've been in my own business now for 20 years. I'm used to taking initiative. And those, I have to say, you know, those are the great things about the Girls on the Run program here in Milwaukee is it's taking girls at a young age and not only teaching them physical strength, which gives you optimism and endorphins, but also positive values of character and connectedness and confidence. And those are such important skills for life. Girls on the Run really makes a difference for girls in their whole lives.
That sensibility that you can gain in sports of self-discipline and really taking that initiative. How did you decide to, after your sporting career, then apply that to the business sphere? Because I imagine a lot of athletes have trouble deciding what their next step is after they're done being athletes. But it seems like you seamlessly transitioned and you've built a lot of different aspects of your professional career.
Well, I did a lot of speaking when I was trying to raise money for skiing. I always joke and say, you know, people say it's hard to ski with one leg. I say it's really hard to ski with no money. So I spent a lot of time fundraising, and that meant a lot of speaking in different places. And I wrote proposals, and so taking those skills into my job now. And our most recent book is Micro Resilience. And again, the resilience that I had to show to learn how to walk again after my leg was amputated to then, you know, become an athlete when nobody would even, you know, had me on high school teams. You know, so taking that resilience and turning it around and saying, you know, how can I give that resilience to other people?
Well, and one story of resilience that stuck out was when you broke both legs. So
not at the same time. I broke one leg on a ski simulator. It was the first day of school in Vermont at this, you know, high achieving athlete school. Fell off, broke my ankle. And so I'm in a cast and, you know, I can lift weights, but I can't do a lot of other things. And then finally get out of that cast and I'm running across the soccer field and I hear my artificial leg crack. And then we mailed it from Vermont back to Los Angeles where it was made and it got shipped back surface. So it was like 3 weeks in the mail. Oh. And I'm on crutches. So I was on crutches like for months that fall. But it builds character.
It does.
It's definitely about resilience, though, about always being able to come back and keep, you know, no matter how many, fall down 7 times, get up 8, right?
Yeah. Well, and micro resilience kind of has these 5 key aspects that you go into that can shift focus, drive, and energy. But normally you're speaking to a corporate audience. But with events like this, such as Girls on the Run, how do you shift and turn that message to apply for young girls in their everyday lives?
Well, what's great about micro-resilience, and we coined the term micro-resilience to talk about really small pieces of resilience. People tend to think of resilience as big things like turning around after alcoholism or, you know, rebuilding a town after a hurricane. But we're looking at micro, tiny, which means it's easy to. And so what we can share with the girls are little things that they can do every day to make yourself more resilient today. And one of the fun ones that we'll be sharing is the Joy Kit, which is a first aid kit for your attitude. And I love that. Like, who doesn't need a first aid kit for your attitude?
Exactly.
You have Band-Aids and ointments, you know, in case you get a burn or a cut. But why not be prepared for when you're going to get an injury to your attitude? And so what we do is we have bags that we're going to be giving away that have the Joy Kit written on it. And I'm going to ask some of the girls to write down on the back of the bag with a Sharpie what they would put in their Joy Kit. So it gets them to think about, how can I be empowered to turn around my attitude? And it could be a picture of your puppy. You know, it could be a note from your best friend. It could be a shiny stone that you found at the beach when you were on vacation, you know, just things. And what goes in your Joy Kit's different than what goes in my Joy Kit. But it's great to learn that at an early age, that what happens to you doesn't have to, you know, it can make you feel a certain way, but then you have the power to turn that around. And some adults have never learned that, right? You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's a quick and easy way. And actually, that's something that people love in the corporate setting, too, is you can put it in your desk. You can have a buddy at work. You know, some days when you're having a bad day, the last thing you're thinking about is your Joy Kit, but your buddy can pull something out and put it on your desk to, you know, help you put things in perspective.
One thing that personally helps me with my attitude is exercise and various things. And obviously, being an athlete and speaking to girls on the run, which is teaching young girls to build up that endurance and eventually participate in a 5K. What do you do today, exercise-wise, or while you're traveling amidst? And do you still miss that aspect of skiing?
A fun fact, though, that from micro-resilience, so this is something that I learned that, you know, long after I stopped being a full-time athlete, that really changed the way I think about exercise. This is really important, is, you know, the normal ways you think, 3 times a week, I'm going to exercise for an hour, you know, and get really sweaty and, you know, do that, and it's great. But if you're having a really intense day, you have to give a presentation or you have to finish a proposal on a deadline, you'll probably think, well, I exercised yesterday, I'll exercise tomorrow, but I got to just focus on this today, so I'm not going to exercise. And that's how I always used to think. But the research shows that a little bit of exercise can actually make you smarter for hours. So you're better able to access memory. You're better able to generate new ideas. You're better able to make insights, cross-connecting information. And so if you have a presentation to give or a deadline to meet, you're going to say, oh, wait, I have to budget some time in the morning to exercise because it's going to make me smarter for the rest of the day. So that's really changed my behavior around that. And it doesn't have to be an hour, a really sweaty hour. It could be walking for 20 minutes. There's one study that talks about dancing for 20 minutes, you know, and they show that people can generate more ideas and do better. So it's when you know that's the fact, that you'll be smarter if you exercise, you know, just think about all the girls on the run doing that in the afternoon, and they're going to do better in their homework.
Exactly. You wrote a book with your daughter about leadership. I'm curious, what kind of lessons did you learn from her while you were doing that together?
Oh, that's such a great question. We wrote How Great Women Lead, and we interviewed Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton and an orchestra conductor, a fighter pilot. And, you know, one of the things that really showed up for me is when we think about the next generation of girls, that they have more opportunity than ever before. They have more education. They have more job opportunities. You know, a lot of fights have been fought for them. Not all of them, but some. And yet, when they look around and they look at boardrooms and suits and ties, and still the tops of most companies are still very male, they think, you know, and politicians, they think, I don't know if I want to do that. That, you know, they're so into authenticity, right? My phone is my color and this is my thing. And they're like, that's not my personality. I don't want to be like those guys that I see doing this. And so a lot of them are like, I don't want to aspire to those jobs that other people have paved the way for them to be able to do. And what we saw with our daughter, Darcy, was that by going through meeting these amazing women who were in these high roles in so many places, the chairman of Deloitte, a fighter pilot, the president of Liberia, even Gina Davis, an award-winning actress, they brought their own personality to the way they led, and they brought their femininity, their personality, their quirks. And she saw, oh, wait a minute, so I don't have to become like the men that I see. I should bring my own personality to leadership. And I think that's one of the most important lessons we need to give to the next generation of girls. And I think Girls on the Run is really helping us to do that, is to celebrate their personality and the strengths they can bring. I love one of the things they're doing now is having superhero capes for the girls. They have these great pink satin superhero capes. And I was with a group of girls in Hartford, Connecticut a couple of days ago, and I was putting a superhero cape on a girl, and I asked her, you know, what's your superpower? And she said, smartness. I'm smart. And there was another girl who's disabled. She's missing her elbows. Her arms don't really work. And I said, what's your superpower? And she said, I'm fast. The power of who you are and who you're going to become is really dependent on something inside, is your vision, your self-esteem, your confidence, and your ability to set goals and communicate and connect with other people. And so I want to affirm what Girls on the Run is doing and really encourage the community to get behind this, because we need the power of girls. You know, we need the power of women. As well as men, you know, but we need to all be leading side by side to solve the complex problems that we're dealing with in the world today.
And how do you think these young girls that you'll speak with that will grow up to be the next leaders, or when you speak with corporate adults, how would you describe peak performance for people? Your book goes into utilizing tools to have your ultimate best performance, your best
self. Well, that's a great question about peak performance, because I so much in my early life was just the drive until you drop kind of person. You know, you push yourself until you fall over from exhaustion and you say, see how tough I am? And there's a lot of that attitude in the workplace. And what we discovered with micro-resilience is that doing tiny adjustments along the way, you can actually sustain your highest level of performance much longer. So it's not a wimpy wellness kind of a thing, you know, of saying, you know, oh, just relax more, you know. It's really about a higher level of performance. And mm-hmm. we got the idea from research that was done on tennis players. They were looking at why certain tennis players were consistently the most winningest tennis players ever. You know, when you're looking at the U.S. Open, there's all these people playing, but there's only a handful of names you're looking at because they always win. And he couldn't find a common element of why they would always win until he started looking at what they did between the points. And he found that they had small behaviors, little adjustments that they did, like even just little as putting your racket from one hand to the other hand. And he saw that the top players all did these things. And as you went down the ranks, they did less and less. And when you got to the bottom, they didn't do any of them. So when you think about it, if we're playing tennis, we both have world-class skills. But if I'm getting a little more energy and more rejuvenation along the way, by the end of the match, I am running twice as fast as you are and hitting twice as hard. So we wanted to apply that to the rest of the world. You know, whether you're in a big corporate job or whether you're a stay-at-home mom, you know, just you're working hard. You're trying to get the most out of life. And so being able to add these little recoveries along the way makes such a difference.
Bonnie St. John is a Paralympic ski medalist, best-selling author, and leadership and keynote speaker. She was in Milwaukee last month to speak at a Girls on the Run of Greater Milwaukee event. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. There's more information about St. John and about Girls on the Run at WUWM.com. Today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.